Well, how many people have read either of these two books, Under the Banner of Heaven or Prophets Pray?
I read most of it, Prophets Pray. Mm-hmm. I mean, not most of it, I read the first third. Mm-hmm.
I read Prophets Pray and the first few chapters mm-hmm. of Under the Banner of Heaven.
I haven't read either
one.
Mary, do you want to introduce the program?
Oh. Okay, well this is...
Well, let me say first, welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison for our monthly meeting this month at Bethel Horizons near Dodgeville. And our speaker today is Mary Franz.
I'm not exactly a speaker, I'm just leading, stimulating discussion.
Facilitator.
And the title of your talk, discussion?
Well, I think Bob and I came up with a title of, what was it, something like Civil Liberties versus... Criminal behavior. What did he say at the
bottom corner?
Oh, when does civil liberty cross the line to criminal action?
Mm-hmm. That's fundamentalist Mormons.
And if anyone has read much, even a few chapters of either of these books, they certainly probably have some strong opinions on that subject. I could give you a little background for those who haven't read the book. John Krakauer, who's written several excellent books about adventures and things like that, got involved in this subject when the murders of a mother and a baby by fundamentalist Mormons hit the headlines, and he became involved in interviewing people around the perpetrators and others in the sect, and realized that this was not an isolated episode, that this was almost standard action, that a prophet, usually a self-declared prophet, would have heard from God that so-and-so should be eliminated, and some of them had lists they carried around. And in this case, the brothers who murdered Brenda she was their sister-in-law. She is married to another brother of theirs. And they murdered her in her early 30s and her infant daughter in cold blood, just because this was their command. Krakauer writes an excellent book going back and forth between this was happened in 1984, between the events at the time and the history of the Mormon religion and the way in which the fundamentalist Mormons had their rise to increasing numbers. The Mormon religion is, I think most of us, who, even if you were a Mormon, you'd probably be aware of this, that it's a very authoritarian religion, very patriarchal, that it's not considered okay to question what the prophet says, the current prophet. The prophet is the president. This is the mainstream Mormons. The prophet is the president of all the Mormons in the world, and has two co-presidents. This council of three then meets with 12 men, always men, who are apostles. And if the president dies, he is replaced by the oldest of the apostles. So you can see it gets to be a pretty geriatric government. And it's very hierarchical, and nobody... It's very patriarchal because no women have any power other in the hierarchy. Nevertheless, the Mormons thrived because they had very good, well, once they went through a good deal of persecution in the 19th century in the process of finding their way to Utah, where they sort of had a free hand to develop their own society. Polygamy was a part of the doctrine, if you'd call it that, the commandments, and they held on to this despite lot of opposition by the federal government and the various states. Finally, in 1890, or shortly before that, they decided that they're, well, this is kind of an, it's not a catty way to put it, they decided their financial interests were such that they'd better knuckle under and abandon the model of polygamy because the federal government was going to seize all their assets. Mm. Nevertheless, at that time, they didn't really give up, the elders didn't give up the idea of polygamy. They just didn't advertise it as such. The first wife would be legally married, and then they'd have the subsequent wives would be concubines, essentially. And this continued in the mainstream Mormons for quite a while. They sent colonies off to Mexico and Canada at that time, very early in the 20th century, where I guess they figured they wouldn't be as persecuted as they were in the United States. I don't know how the Canadians felt about it. Polygamy was illegal in their country also. It's not entirely clear to me exactly when the fundamentalists broke away from the mainstream. I think the mainstream became more and more mainstream, and generations of monogamous marriages ensued, and I think people who live in that part of the country agree that the Mormons were good citizens and took care of their own, were prosperous, and most people were pretty tolerant and comfortable with the Mormons. But the fundamentalist Mormons, I can't remember tell you exactly when this began, that okay, in about 1920, the population of this Arizona Strip, or the location, attracted them because they were in the state of Arizona, but it was several hundred miles to get to the next town in Arizona over the other side of the Grand Canyon. So they were kind of, and Utah law couldn't touch them, so they were essentially in a little private enclave. And this town of Short Creek, or Colorado City, or Hilldale, all of those names seem to apply, grew. And you may have heard or read about the state of Arizona finally raided the town of Short Creek and jailed the polygamists, the men, and removed the women and children to Kingman, the other side of the Grand Canyon, the county seat, I guess, and tried to put the children in foster care. Well,
that was what, in the
50s? 1953, yeah. And this was, the pictures in the newspapers, I don't remember seeing them myself. Do you remember? But this really disturbed the rest of the populace in the United States. How could we do this? These people are just following out their religious freedom. You're tearing infants away from their mothers and their fathers and breaking up families.
Definitely not good PR.
you haven't heard anything yet. So this created quite a storm, and it fizzled out. The federal government and state of Arizona ended up with egg on their face for sure. And so nothing came of that. They continued to thrive in Short Creek, and one of the ways they thrived was that if only the first wife was a legal wife, then all the subsequent wives and there were single mothers, and there were eligible for welfare payments. So the town of Short Creek really thrived financially on federal and state funds. It's believed that in a period of, how many years did they say? Period of about 5 or more years, that little community probably got over $1 million in welfare funds. And in addition to money that went to the community for building an airport, highways, schools, without any accountability. Maybe somebody has some opinions to express at this point. What about civil?
Maybe it would be worth mentioning that in this small community, all the officials were themselves fundamentalist Mormons.
Oh, yes.
So,
yeah. So there was essentially no police force, because the mayor and all the police force were of the same sect. And the way Brower, this author of the second book, he's a private investigator who responded to an appeal from a man who had been kicked out of the church, and it was customary if the prophet decided that someone was a threat to the church and its doctrines, why, they'd not only be excommunicated from the church, but all their property would be taken away, and their wives. Their wives would be reassigned to other, and wives and children would be reassigned to other more loyal members of the community. Well, Sam Brower, was intrigued by this, and he heard this property holder had been kicked out of his home, and his wives had been removed. And so he went to kind of find out what was going on, and he lived nearby in Cedar City, and he was a mainstream Mormon himself. He said, well, this can't be. Couldn't possibly be happening. So he went down, and right while he was there, the police were coming and kicking this man out of his house. And what they finally did was have him move into the basement of the house and remodel the house so that the loyal Mormon brother could move into the house. Well, anyway, Brower became quite intrigued by this. This was in 2004. And so he told Chaplain, that he'd be glad to be hired on as a private investigator. Well, Chaplain said, I don't have any money. He said, well, I'll do it for a dollar. He said, I don't have a dollar. So Brower takes a dollar out of his pocket and gives it to Chaplain, that takes it back and says, you've hired me for your private investigator.
Who was Chaplain?
He was the one who was
dispossessed. Kicked out.
Yeah. But all this time, while the private investigator was telling the police, well, this is illegal, you can't be doing this to this guy. So then they got some court official who's also a member of the Klan to come in and say, oh, here's a permit. Anytime there was an obstacle, they make new permits. This opened his eyes to what was really going on there, and he just couldn't leave it alone. He was just fascinated and wanted to, throughout his book, I think he does a very good job, and he probably did a good job as a private investigator, trying not to get emotionally involved, but to deal with the facts and try to dot the I's and cross the T's so that everything he did was above board. But what Krakauer uncovered in the years before that, because this murder of the mother and baby happened 20 years before that, and he's talking about that and how the two brothers, did come to justice fairly promptly. But meanwhile, this was just the tip of the iceberg, because the poor old wives were not just mature people deciding to get married and deciding a second or third wife would be fine. These were teenage girls, many of them below the legal age of marriage. The youngest, I think they mentioned in the book, was 12. And
maybe you want to pass the Brower book around, because it has photographs in the middle, including some of the, like, the prophet's 12-year-old bride.
And the women were just basically considered to be baby factories, and the girls were groomed and bred to be married off to mostly these older men. The other side of the thing is, what did they do with all the boys? After all, here were these young men coming up, and young men and young women are going to be attracted to each other. So they have, one way and another, they managed to evict most of the young men, unless they were real leadership potential from the communities. And this was another scandal, the Lost Boys.
They just dump them on the side of the road.
The parents would be told, your 13, 14-year-old son is a danger to you, your family. And they held this fear of hell and eternal damnation, not just that they'd have retribution there in Short Creek, but that they would suffer throughout eternity because of harboring this 14-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. And so the parents themselves would take this child out and maybe put a couple of dollars in his pocket and tell him, you're on your own.
Yeah. What did the parents do about the young girls?
Well, they
allow it?
Oh, they took them be married.
They were not under the general laws, for example, that a 12-year-old cannot be married.
It wasn't a legal marriage. No. They would call it a sealing.
Spiritual marriage.
They would tell them, now you're married to this old guy.
It was basically rape of these young teenage girls.
Uh-huh.
And presumably from then on they'd be protected by this man who had raped them and acquired them. But in actuality, they might very well be, by the time he had 50, 60 of these young women in his stable, why, some of the older ones would be pretty much left on their own to keep the children survive the best they could.
Now, did the main administration of the Mormon Church, I mean the upper echelon, did they know about this or did they do anything about that?
I think they probably knew quite a bit about it, but they didn't really want to know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. They said, these are not Mormons.
They expelled them or communicated them. Yeah, one way
they would publicly say these are not Mormons.
Back in the 20s, right? They expelled
they were saying
them.
That
they expelled them all from the Mormon Church.
And,
and the fundamentalists say, well, the mainstream Mormons have strayed from the teachings of Joseph Smith, and the central tenet of this religion is plural marriage or polygamy. So they claim that they were the true followers of the religion revealed by Joseph Smith.
They were not particularly secretive about this. One man who lived in western Utah with his 10 wives and 32 children publicized what he was doing. He was on a TV show, and that really got the attention of the state prosecutors, I think. But the state prosecutor who succeeded in putting this man behind bars for the rape of these teenagers and, child abuse in general, he lost his next election because the popular support was for these families, you know. And these children, the women are brainwashed as young girls, and many times when they're interviewed, they would say, I'm very happy here, this is wonderful, having these co-wives is great, I have company. Well, they didn't have much company from their husbands, so they had to put up with the girls, other girls' company, and caring for their babies. So it was very hard. I don't really fault the press, except for not going into more depth about it and just saying, well, here's a scene, here are these happy children playing together with all their step-siblings and so on.
There was a cover story in the National Geographic magazine that I meant to bring.
Oh,
with
yes.
a picture of this, one of the...
I read that years
the,
ago.
Mormon, fundamentalist Mormon, with all his children and grandchildren, the enormous crowd behind him in the Short Creek area. And it was a very sympathetic coverage. It wasn't any real criticism of the suffering caused to the children and this sort of thing. Sam Brower, when he wrote his book, mentioned that some of the people in his book were actually in the photographs in the National Geographic article.
Yeah, I think the problem is when somebody doesn't want to conform to the system.
Well, then
they're not allowed to not conform.
That's
when you run into trouble.
They lose their house, they lose their livelihood, the others will shun them. The very few of them elect to remain in Short Creek. One of the people he talks to, I get these two books mixed up. I think it's John Krakauer is talking to a man who went off to college. He was very bright and in schooling and came back to teach in Short Creek, and he finally started talking back to the main prophet, and so he was excommunicated, lost his family, but his wives didn't leave him. No, they would not go. So the whole family is excommunicated.
Yeah. And the federal government did not get involved in any way.
Well, they did.
Because there are federal laws, you know.
Oh, yeah, there are. Well, the climax of Brower's book is he's talking about the leader from 2000, well, the turn of the century. There was a Rulon Jeffs who was the leader from about 1980, 1990s. And he was the prophet, and his son was a very intelligent but a very warped personality, and he kind of saw to it as his father aged that he, of the many, many sons, was going to be the next leader, and he brainwashed the old man and saw to it that the old man passed the mantle on to him. And even when the old man was supposedly issuing the words of God, Warren, his son, had saw to it that they were his messages. And Warren, I would say most of these prophets were mentally disturbed, if not psychotic, and Warren was extreme in that manner, and he just had to assert power for its own sake, one thing after another. They couldn't have TV, they couldn't read newspapers, they couldn't read magazines, they weren't even supposed to talk to Gentiles. Gentiles is anybody who isn't a Latter-day Saint. And the schools were totally taken over by their community and their teaching, so that it was pretty rare for a young person, young men, young women never went off to college, but pretty rare for young men to get to go to off to college.
And wasn't Rulon the one that supposedly would live forever?
Yeah, they thought he was going to live forever.
So when he finally died, they had some explaining to do.
His spirit was living on in Warren. And Warren Jeffs he had extremely grandiose ideas. Well, they all did, because they all felt that the world was going to end, that the world was a battleground between the forces of Jesus and God and the forces of Satan. And everybody who didn't agree with them was part of Satan's army.
Right.
And so they all felt the end of the world was near. Time after time they predict the end of the world, and they honestly believed that, don't worry, because pretty soon the world's going to end and we will be surviving and the rest will be thrashing around in nether regions.
And Warren Jeffs decided to build this big temple in Texas.
So he built a huge compound there. They have lots of money because of various schemes, and the money all goes to the church. If the church doesn't think it has enough money, it just tells all the members, you must give another $1,000, you must do this, you must do that, and the people were in real poverty. They were very hard workers. They could underbid anybody on a construction project because they had all this slave labor to
kids.
Child labor. Yeah, kids as young as 8 were seen working on some of these construction sites that the organization was being paid for. Well, so anyway, they had a lot of money, and they decided to build this fortress in West Texas, I think in a fairly isolated area. They bought a huge amount of land, walled it in, put security guards all around it, and built a huge complex there. And that was where they felt they were going to be able to rule the world from there. But he had these very grandiose ideas.
But Sam Brower,
Sam Brower.
Started to investigate that.
Yeah.
Some of his information came when he went to Texas.
No, he was able to befriend the local law enforcement agents who were not Mormons and were concerned, but they had to work very hard to try to get a case, you know. They were all too reminiscent of what had happened in Waco, yeah.
Which was just a few miles away from this place
they were building. Really didn't want, and the federal government was very involved in this, the FBI was involved in it. So they did eventually get Warren in jail. They caught him, finally.
Right, he was traveling all around the country, keeping away from the authorities for quite a while.
Well, he was also living a very much of a playboy existence with a couple of his wives.
Right.
They would say, this is in the matter of research, they would be seen on the beach in Florida wearing bikinis and shorts, which, you know, Mormons always buttoned up to the neck and the ankles. So, but that was just so they could investigate the evil world out there.
And so they wouldn't be discovered, because they would have been obvious if they'd worn
the uniforms.
Yeah, if
they wore Mormon gear on the beach, they would have been. But he was finally caught and went to jail, and he was really, he just fell apart in jail, because the a child molester is the bottom of the heap in jail, and so even though he was in solitary confinement, so the others couldn't physically abuse him, they taunted him and shouted at him, and he was used to having all this praising people around him. Then he somehow got, he was being tried in, I didn't get all of this, it's pretty complicated, he was being tried in Utah and in Arizona and in Texas. And he served a number, quite a time in Utah, and this is, he became very mentally and physically emaciated, you might say. Then he went to Texas, and this is an interesting angle, because in Texas some of those prisons are privately run, and for some reason, well, probably because he had a lot of money, he got a chance to have a telephone, his own telephone, not stand in line to use it, so he could run his whole outfit from his solitary confinement cell.
He could send sermons to his church.
Mm-hmm. So this went on for a while, and he is presumably still in jail, but the attempt to end the Ranch of Zion, which is a big place in Texas, they did not succeed in making those prosecutions stick. So I don't know what the status of it is now, but at the time he finishes the book, he's saying, sooner or later this will happen, but it isn't happening just now. So there hasn't been a change of the culture. It's still there. And there's tens of thousands of these fundamentalist Mormons. And ironically, the more the mainstream Mormons become part of mainstream American life, the more fundamentalists are recruited, because they've been brainwashed to think this is the truth of Joseph Smith and our church isn't following it, so I will go to this other church.
How many wives did Joseph Smith have?
Oh, 60-some.
Joseph Smith? He did.
He had a lot.
And even Brigham Young had many wives.
Mm-hmm. The appalling thing is the sexual abuse that took place. It wasn't just having wives and babies. There was incest going on. The fathers would consider it was part of their responsibility to impregnate their daughter when she got to be 12 years old. And they were also abusing young boys. There was a school in near Salt Lake City.
That private Warren Jeffs was the principal.
Yeah. And they would systematically abuse the young boys there, sexually abuse them such that...
2008. So this went into the...
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, this,
well, this is
Jeff was just in prison in 2006.
Really incredible.
This is current history.
Yeah.
And, this isn't some ancient...
And Brower's book ends in 2011, but I'm sure there's a lot more stuff.
What I thought was amazing, because at least the girls, by and large, were nurtured. It's the boys who were just dumped. And so there was one guy who had been in the Mormon, these fundamentalist things and had left, who started making it his mission to take in these young boys and help
teach them about, I mean, they...
What life? They didn't know how to...
Because they had no idea what life outside of the town
was. They didn't know how to go to a restaurant and order a meal. How to apply for a job. They worked. They were hard workers, but... Yeah.
And had basically no education.
Mm-hmm. You could read and write.
Barely.
So are all these perpetrators in jail now?
No, they are not. And this is what Brown is upset about. And you just almost wonder what a slow process it would be to change this culture. The people who are in are loyal, and the people who are out are sometimes trying to get back in.
And
being very servile. Yeah.
And they said they don't, in Brower's book, he said that they don't, they're not open to people joining, mm-hmm. you know. This is a pretty closed
yeah,
group.
Of course. Right.
But because they have all of these children, and all the children become, you know.
Are they going to school in case?
Get a little elementary education,
and that's about it.
If they go to public school,
they don't
know.
Public schools are running.
Oh, they have their own private schools.
No, there's a public school. The school district in Torrey Creek They are the public school.
It's
supported by the state of Arizona. But apparently nobody has been able to make them meet standards. No child left behind those. You can't even see them.
Yeah. So they're not getting. This is very closed. Your closed culture producing mm-hmm. tons and tons and tons of kids, which are then so it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, mm-hmm. and all those people they tithe at the basic. Everybody gives a tenth of their stuff, and then
give more.
Warren felt that they were short of money to build this big temple, so he had people give more, and the people were, you know, some of them not even having enough food, but they were still forced to give up.
They were forced. They were also so ignorant and
totally
stupid.
They know nothing. You know, if you've been raised for generations, nothing except what's there.
You have no connection
really
to the internet or the outside world.
That's really scary.
People come to town who are outsiders, there's a system of intimidation where these guys in their pickup trucks with the tinted windows see their car come to town that doesn't belong to them, and they start following them around.
So Brower had to figure all that out, and he was apparently a rather intimidating figure himself, tall
and
large.
This is really a matter of
finally,
the FBI.
Finally, the state of Arizona had a sheriff living on this. Brower describes it as one of the few pieces of land that wasn't owned by the local group. And so he has an office there, and he and Brower were working. Supporting one another.
So are there any attacks on Brower? I mean, they must know about this.
He watches his back.
That's what I'm saying. He's probably in danger.
Well, he's well armed. As a private detective, he knows how to use his weapon.
I forgot about
At one point, he confronted one of these guys who were following him in a truck. He came over there with his gun. And
you won't recognize your face when I'm done with you. He went in for some court hearing in Texas, he checked into the motel, the reception girl says, "Oh, your friend has got the room next to you." And he said, "I don't know anybody. I never told anybody I was coming here." But apparently they got wind that he was going to be there, and they made telephone calls to the motel saying, "We're friends of Brower, and we want to be close to his room." So the room's on all around where he was supposed to go. But he caught up on this thanks to the girl telling him, "Your friend is there."
Yeah.
And so he called the FBI, and the FBI quickly took him and put him into another motel and kept an eye on him.
Okay, they did that, but did they go after the perpetrators?
Well, they did was reserve rooms at the motel. That was no crime.
You can't get
they know in the meantime
knew what was going on.
The whole child abuse.
And they have, because this is such a closed society, nobody wants to testify. No. So that was also one of the problems, that even when they could try to document abuse, they couldn't get anybody who would testify.
A pregnant 12-year-old?
Right, exactly.
They'd get a girl to say she was really fed up, she was running away, but when it came to actually going into court and facing, and they would manage to get her parents or other people from the community to surround her, and they just wouldn't. But they did get one of the boys who was abused testified.
And they got enough evidence to put Warren Jeffs in jail for a long time.
But it was a lot of
work. But the subject of our discussion, this is interesting because the ACLU and the gay rights people were defending these people's against their accusations of polygamy, because they would say, well, they don't call it polygamy, but sexual license is widespread. And
the ACLU.
I couldn't find out anything about whether the ACLU has changed that that support.
Now I'm going to guess that these are extreme examples.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course. Something that's happening more commonly that would might be more acceptable to mainstream.
No, it's pretty. It's pretty.
As far as a man with three or four adult wives.
Yeah. There are some like that. Yeah.
And those, and I don't think anybody has a whole lot of problem with that.
Right. But the ACL.
There are a few that are in, off by themselves, but mostly they're in these two communities, the Colorado City and bountiful British Columbia.
And another
one. And now the Texas.
But the ACLU also has the habit, I would call it, of the of going over backwards and being so politically correct as to be criminal. I've been a member of the ACLU for many, many years, and I continue to be. But I do not agree with a lot of that stuff.
But this was the religious liberty argument,
and you can really go too far.
Criminal behavior.
And Dorothy's right. If they were all consenting adults, that would be one thing. The problem was, number one, they often weren't consenting adults.
Yeah.
They were children.
And then also this abandonment of the boys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're real. It's a real abandonment issue.
Those are really criminal things.
So that's
The ACLU often banned on corporate free speech for the tobacco industry. So that's a problem with the ACLU.
Yeah, and they also defended Nazis, which this is when I really got mad.
Well,
with
they
the
defended
ACLU.
Their right to assemble.
Yeah.
Well, this is not a basic discussion about the ACLU, but I agree with both.
But it's important because it's the only really important organization.
The other interesting thing is that feminists came out in favor of the mainstream Latter-day Saints, who are, as I said, patriarchal. Women have no major role there, but the feminists came out supporting them because of their stand about monogamy, I guess. So it's... Politics makes strange bedfellows, and so does religion.
Right. Sure,
and
does.
Bedfellows make strange politics.
Yeah.
So both of these books are available from the Madison Public Libraries. And then there are other books that have been written also about the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints by former members.
Sort of wanted to read one woman who was an apostate. Oh, they call the faithful or the Mormons, the apostates are those who have left Mormonism. Mm-hmm. Jack Mormons are still in the church, but they are not practicing. So there's several degrees. And Gentiles are everybody else.
And the very worst are those who were
The
members.
Apostates are much worse than Gentiles.
Right. If you were a believer and then left the church, you're the tool of Satan.
That's
You've
heard of the Baha'i and that same philosophy that a person who leaves the Baha'i faith is shunned by the other Baha'is. And I may be true of the Jehovah's Witnesses to a great extent also. These extremely rigid, enclosed societies can't tolerate apostasy.
One of Conan Doyle's books was about revenge of an apostate Mormon who went to her.
The sign of four, one of his short, well, it's a long, long story, not long enough to be a book. One of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Oh, right, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And that was...
But they pursued
that was
him
the
to
old,
England, yeah.
Yeah, that was the old, yeah.
So mm-hmm. the older, you... Compared to these fundamentalists, the regular Latter-day Saints look pretty good, but their history is not that great. Yeah.
Wasn't this book also made into a movie?
I don't know.
I think it is available under the banner of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of polygamy, it's obvious from the Bible that polygamy was part of the original Jewish tradition.
Right.
And several years ago, I heard that there had been a major assembly of rabbis that stated at about 1000 AD that the Jews would be monogamous for a millennium and then it would be reevaluated. And the time is now ripe for that, so we may have something else to talk about with different details.
If somebody actually follows through on that 1,000 years.
There was one more, in the, we're back to the murder of the mother and the baby. The two brothers made a rather clumsy escape and it wasn't too long before they were caught because two guys they'd muscled in, they had pulled in, to share in the crime did not feel good about it and they left and they agreed to go state's witness so they caught Dan and Ron and they were both tried and during the trial of the second they were Dan was incarcerated for life and Ron there was an attempt to prove insanity. There's a very interesting chapter about the trial and when does religious zealotry become insanity? And the defending lawyer, no, the prosecuting lawyer is the one who wants to prove that he is sane and could have the death penalty. The defending lawyer is trying to prove he's insane. So these two lawyers are debating whether he's a religious zealot or insane. And they get into quite some psychiatric jargon that he's not schizophrenic. He said, how different is he from any religious prophet who believes that God is speaking to him? And the final diagnosis that they agreed on, which probably sounds reasonable to me, is a recent one in the psychiatric manual, narcissistic personality disorder. And this is the person who believes he or she is totally different. The normal rules of society don't apply. They're leaders, they're prophets.
So where is he now?
Well, Ron has had death penalty, but is still undergoing appeals, and Dan is still in jail. But that's as the time that Krakauer wrote his book, and I don't have
it. I recall that one of the brothers got a lighter sentence, that they had two separate trials, and the jury was less sympathetic when the second trial came around.
That's why he didn't get the death penalty. Well, when Dan was tried, the foreman of the jury said, Dan was such a charismatic person that a woman juror fell under his spell just by his nonverbal communications and refused to vote for the, the death penalty either, but I believe they both belong out of society for life.
But they were unrepentant.
There were no remorse whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In fact, when Krakauer spent a lot of time with Dan, who was very free to talk about everything, he calls his prison cell, he's in a maximum security prison. He's shackled to the wall of his own cell. He gets out only for brief to take a shower or to work in the cafeteria serving meals. Imagine that. But so John Krakauer says, what's the difference between you and Osama bin Laden? He's following a prophet, and he's committing murder. And this made Dan really stop and think for a while. And he said, I think it's because I'm right and he's wrong. He's following a false. He's following a false prophet, and I am.
That's true believers always believe.
There was an interesting case in there of, in the Broward book, of a young woman who had fled.
Yeah.
You know, she was supposed to be married to the prophet, and she crawled out a window, I think, and fled, and ended up in the community in Canada. And Warren Jeffs wanted her back, so he was ready to do blood atonement, which means murder somebody.
Yeah.
And the guy who was the head of the community in Canada hit her and refused to send her back. Jeffs sent her father, the girl's father, up to fetch her and bring her back so that she could be killed. And the guy up he said, no, this isn't right. So he hit her, so the father had to go back without her. And in the end, they got the federal government involved in that one. And she ended up moving back to Short Creek, which I think shows how... all of her friends, all of her family, he says she's probably the safest person in two countries because everybody had been so focused on saving her, and the federal government knew exactly what was going on. If anything had happened to her, they would have been down like a ton of bricks. So she ended up being able to go back and not with him. She had fallen in love with a age appropriate young man, and they wanted to get married, and in the end they did.
That's sort of the exception.
It was the real exception to the rule, but people did. And then Jeff's in the end, they said he has a long memory, and he ended up getting this guy that was the head of the community in Canada kicked out. I don't know if he was fully excommunicated or just...
He was his rank was lowered from being a bishop.
Being the head of the had somebody else come in as the head of it. And then the father, who came back without his daughter, he was excommunicated. And it was, the father who really tried to get his daughter back, he was punished along with the guy who said, no, I won't send her back. So, not a lot of...
So, interesting. Some of the things they have been caught up on, of course, have been their financial dealings, but even that, it's very hard to make it stick. They have this huge company, it has all the holdings of land and money for the fundamentalist group in Short Creek, the UEP. And there was, that went back and forth. I don't know how it finally ended up, but one court would say, you can't take their money away, and another one, they were trying to put it in a trust that was more accessible to the people who could give them the money.
What were they trying to get them for racketeering?
Yeah, they've been fraud and racketeering and tax evasion. Interesting figure that the people in Short Creek get $8 from the state and federal government for every dollar they pay in taxes, whereas the average, even in a poor state, is close to 1-on-1.
We should send Scott Walker to Arizona.
Well, maybe he would like to be the governor, the mayor of Short Creek or something.
Of a prophet. So did they, I never got to the end of that book, and maybe he doesn't say, but once Jeffs was jailed, was he still functioning as the prophet? Did they get another prophet, or did they keep him as the prophet?
At least while he had phone access from a private prison in Texas, he was able to continue as the prophet, as the head of the church.
Did anyone else have phone access in a cell in that prison?
I think a lot of people had
the telephone.
Their own private phones.
As the shift to Texas was made, he still remained the uncontested leader.
This one is absolutely unique.
Yes.
This is not our usual discussion.
All right. Well, it's good to know. Good to know.
Somehow I feel I need to say this. When I was a very new and very pregnant immigrant to this country, I lived in California, and where my first child was born. And my next door neighbor happens to have been a Mormon family, and I knew practically nothing about Mormons. And they turned out to be the nicest neighbors that I have ever had. And I wanted to find out about Mormonism. And she was they were mainstream Mormons, and they did not at all try to proselytize or convince me. And I had read a little bit about polygamy and stuff. And so there are some people on the regular or normal fringe of Mormonism, and I always find it so hard when people like that are on the outer extreme, you know. And then I have to remember Laura and her husband, who were such honest and just plain nice people, who taught me how to keep house. I was an only child. We had a housekeeper. I never learned how to cook and to clean and stuff. Yeah. And she helped me with everything. And if I had, you know, a lot of questions, she would honestly answer them. And so there are people like that also, you know.
Oh, the vast majority of Mormons are wonderful.
They're really nice
people. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they're good family people.
And what I liked, I mean, she was not proselytizing.
They are not these
people. She was not trying to convince me. And I mean, I was at that time, I had been brought up a Lutheran, but I'm not very active Lutheran, and I had my doubts before I finally found the Unitarians. And she was interested in that, and she took that in stride. So, you know, I just feel she was so nice to me. I have to say this as one other example.
Had Mormon missionaries?
She explained, I've met them in Frankfurt, uh-huh. Germany. And you could always tell who they were because they were dressed so very nicely with a tie and starched shirts and everything. And if they came to the door and you didn't want to talk, you politely declined, and they politely accepted.
Yeah.
You know?
Headed to a watchtower.
There's
it. Yeah, it's a whole, the mainstream Mormons is a whole.
Oh, okay. It's a
whole different thing.
I think at the time the book was finished, he was still definitely the leader.
Uh-huh.
But there was, Brower goes on and describes the potential future leaders, and he isn't very optimistic that there will be any improvement.
Uh-huh. Well, and when Jeff's took over, he got rid of a very beloved elderly man that he pretty much ran out because he didn't want the competition.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Mm-hmm. And his own brothers,
right?
He ends out too. Mm-hmm.
So he did a lot to consolidate power, shall we say?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So, it was fascinating. Both books are just fascinating.
Very it sounds really interesting.
Really, that the reaction of the general public to wanting to believe the best of these people, and perhaps having had experience like you did, well, Mormons aren't bad people, and so not realizing that this is a bunch of psychotic,
leader,
group.
And it also, I think, shows the power of sort of how you bring people up.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, you know, what you teach children really matters. For better or worse.
It also shows the dangers of religion, you know, of organized religion and institutionalized religion. Mm. And there are always exceptions, you know, and normal and decent people. But boy, when they get to the fringe, it's really, watch out.
I don't remember the name of the book because I read it some time ago by a mainstream Mormon who had left the church, and her description of how she was brainwashed through childhood and adolescence, and how exciting it was to be brought into the temple for the, I guess it's like the first communion to people.
And it's this human basic need for belonging somewhere, and being part of the whole.
Which is why the people don't want to leave the
community. That's right.
You know, when they when the men are kicked out and and they said, you know, no, you have to leave. Leave your house, leave your family.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, that's
their social
resistance. It's scary.
They don't know anybody outside of that town.
It's
just
not like your typical American adolescent who can't wait to leave home.
Well, or the husbands who are kicked out, you know, who have maybe three wives and 15 kids, and they're devoted to their wives and children, and then all of a sudden somebody says, I'm sorry. You're done. You have to leave town, the only town you've ever known, the family who you cherish, and bye, you're gone.
Awful. You're talking about undocumented immigrants now being deported to Mexico
That's true. That's
they don't
true.
Know a soul.
They probably only have one wife, not three, but it's the same sort of getting pushed away.
Being
from
sent off to somewhere totally foreign.
Like the gal who... this is a whole other topic, but is it Mary was telling us that she ran into that young man over in the Mexican border that had been deported, who was brought to the U.S. at age like 3. He couldn't speak, he was deported, he couldn't even speak Spanish.
Yeah.
He knew no one, and there he was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's true. That's an interesting analogy. Interesting analogy.
Anybody wants to find out more information, you can just Google it on the internet, and you'll find things on YouTube and references
Google
to
Google the name of the
Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The one YouTube video I saw was from someone who had been, I think he's one of the lost boys who was kicked out, went back in his truck and drove around Short Creek taking videos. And talking.
Oh, yeah.
So-and-so lived there, and this is where I was, and this sort of thing.
So the two books again were Under the Banner of Heaven by John Krakauer,
right?
And The Prophet's Prey,
P-R-E-Y,
correct,
by
Sam Brower.
Well, thank you very much, Mary.
Those were meaty books to try to condense.
Oh, yeah, for sure.